Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Sorry for the delay. Great to see everybody here tonight. My name's Peter Tribowitz. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department and the director of the Fallon United States Center, which is hosting this evening's lecture. So tonight's lecture is the seventh and concluding lecture in our year-long series, America's Changing Role in the World. Don't worry, we'll be back next year, because that's one thing I'm going to go out on a limb here. America's role in the world will not be settled by next year. Though it's possible that tonight's speaker will try to settle it here and now. Anyway, for those of you who have joined us in previous events, you know that the series is premised on the idea that America is in the throes of a rethink about its foreign policy purposes and its priorities, a process that began before Donald Trump took office, but has accelerated on his watch, and often in surprising and unpredictable ways. We very much wanted to bring speakers to the school who had a view on what the Trump administration was about, or how to think about the Trump administration and its foreign policy, what it might mean for America's place in the world going forward, and given America's outsized power, what it might mean for the world itself. And so we are very pleased tonight to welcome Sir Neil Ferguson to the LSE, who really needs very, as the ovation when we walked in, needs very little by way of an introduction. He's been here at the LSE as a visitor a couple of times, visiting professor, and he's currently a visiting professor in the School of Public Policy. Briefly, Neil is the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution in Stanford, and a Senior Faculty Fellow at the Belfer Center for Science in International Affairs at Harvard. He's a prize-winning author with 16 books under his belt. He's also an award-winning filmmaker and founder and managing director of Green Mantle, macroeconomic and geopolitical advisory firm. I think many of you, like me, know him also in his capacity as a contributor in the public space for many years in outlets such as the Sunday Telegraph, Newsweek, the Financial Times, the Sunday Times, Bloomberg, and now currently the Free Press. So here's the game plan for tonight. Neil is going to speak for roughly 35 minutes. We'll then turn to discussion before opening it up to your questions in the theater here, and for those of you online. For those of you online, you're going to be able to submit your questions via the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Please be sure to include your name and your affiliation. And maybe just the last kind of housekeeping note here, if you haven't already turned your phone to silent, please do so now so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And with that, please join me in giving Neil Ferguson a warm LSE welcome.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Peter. It's a great pleasure to be back here at the LSE. I'm going to talk, perhaps rather overambitiously, about the foreign policy of Donald Trump in historical perspective. And I'm going to say at least five things with which you will vehemently disagree. It may get higher than five, but five is my batting average. There are all kinds of historical analogies that can be used to try to understand the historical significance of President Trump. And some of them have been current for more than a decade now. I certainly have been reading comparisons of Donald Trump with Hitler since 2016, when he burst onto the American political scene as a candidate for the Republican nomination. Put your hand up if you've read It Can't Happen Here. I always like to give LSE students additional reading, and so that's the first assignment for those of you who haven't read St. Clair Lewis's great 1930s imagining of a fascist America. And so the character in that novel, Buzz Windrip, is a populist who becomes president and turns out to be, in fact, a fascist. Back in 2016, when my old friend Andrew Sullivan was saying Trump is Hitler, I told him, let's use It Can't Happen Here, and if it does happen, as Lewis imagines it, then you'll be right, and if it doesn't, then you'll be wrong. Europeans tend to have a slightly different, though not wholly different, framing. In January last year, it caught my eye that Der Spiegel had Trump with a laurel wreath as Der Imperator. And my old friend Gideon Rachman wrote a good essay in the Financial Times, which you can see illustrated on the right here, depicted President Trump alongside Presidents Putin and Xi carving up the world like a Christmas pudding, an allusion to an early 1800s cartoon of Napoleon and Pitt the Younger carving up the world. So there's the would-be emperor analogy. The odd thing about the Financial Times is that it also is the journal that coined the phrase Trump always chickens out, taco. So he's an emperor, but then he always chickens out, except when he doesn't. Because the problem about taco is that he doesn't always chicken out. In fact, interestingly, President Trump is bluffing roughly half the time on social media, and the other half, he's not. So it's a coin toss whether he's going to chicken out or send stealth bombers to bomb your nuclear facilities, as, of course, he did last year. So you can see why these analogies are slippery. An emperor who sometimes chickens out. My colleagues in the economics profession have been scratching their heads because they can't understand why Trump's tariffs haven't done more damage. There was a great kerfuffle in April of last year. You'll remember, Peter, Liberation Day. And you can see that for a brief period, all the equity indices sold off. But it was a brief period, and they subsequently rallied. And of course, they sold off again at the end of February this year when war broke out with Iran. And then they rallied again. This is all very difficult to explain because tariffs and wars really ought to be much worse for the economy than these charts would seem to suggest. An even trickier question for economists is why Trump's America is leaving the competition in the dust. What I've done in this chart is track the US, German, Japanese, UK, and Chinese A-share indices back to the beginning of the Trump era, to the point at which he was elected for the first time in November 2016. And you'll see that the US economy's performance, at least the US equity market's performance, relative to the competition, has been stellar. And indeed, It had its nastiest period under the Biden-Harris administration. Up until this point, Donald Trump has been a home run for equity investors. Meanwhile, to confuse the picture still further, the Democratic Party lurches ever further to the left, endorsing outright socialism in the case of the mayor of New York, Zoran Mamdani. This is odd because you would have thought, if you were a conventional political scientist, that with the advent of a figure like Trump, the center ground had been left open. And the rational thing in a 1990s framework would have been for the Democrats to occupy that center ground rather than to move further to the left. I am here to urge you to resist facile analogies. Trump is Hitler, Trump is Caesar. These are, I think, somewhat infantile analogies that tell us very little indeed about the United States in the 21st century. And they're not just facile, they're superfluous. We don't need these analogies because there are much better analogies available to us. The analogies that the president himself uses seem like a good starting point. What's interesting about President Trump, for somebody who clearly doesn't spend a great deal of time reading history books, is that he nevertheless has historical figures in mind. This was clear in an interview during the 2024 campaign with Bloomberg when he threw in the name William McKinley, saying that this was his inspiration because McKinley had been tariff man. And it's very important to have an alarm set 10 minutes into the lecture in case you've fallen asleep. I used to do the same as an Oxford undergraduate. So why McKinley, of all people? The president is attracted partly by McKinley's reputation when he was in the House of Representatives as a protectionist, but also, I think, attracted by McKinley's reputation when he was president as a pretty out-and-out imperialist, at least as a president who presided over significant acquisition of territory by the United States. But the trouble with this analogy and the others that come from this sort of period is I'm not sure how helpful they are, given that the situation of the United States is so different from its situation in the late 19th and early 20th century, the Gilded Age. There are many things about America today which are reminiscent of the Gilded Age. Certainly, the significant material inequalities come to mind. The power of big business comes to mind. The rampant corruption comes to mind. But when it comes to foreign policy, it's not clear to me how much President Trump or anybody else can really usefully learn from William McKinley, or for that matter, Theodore Roosevelt. The other very obvious recent allusion to the early 20th century was the Trump corollary, which cropped up in the National Security Strategy published late last year, which is a straightforward copy and paste from the Roosevelt corollary, which was the corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Now, of course, it's the Donroe Doctrine. And the corollary says not only can other countries not interfere in the Americas, but the United States reserves the right to intervene if it doesn't like the look of a government in the Americas. I'll come back to the Trump corollary later. But what I want to begin by showing you is that the situation of the United States is very different today from its situation in the 1890s and early 1900s, when it was an extraordinarily dynamic economy, but in terms of great power politics, not even a middle power, as Mark Carney likes to talk about these days. Today, the United States is the dominant Anglophone hegemon, or if you like, empire, and it has certain peculiar resemblances to other empires, including the last Anglophone empire, particularly in the area of fiscal policy. Ferguson's Law, named, I want to point out, after Adam Ferguson, because I'm not an egomaniac. Ferguson's Law is a straightforward proposition that helps people get their heads around public finance who don't necessarily enjoy that field. It states that any great power that spends more on interest payments on the national debt than on defense won't be a great power for much longer. And the beautiful thing about Ferguson's Law, and it is a beautiful thing, is that it holds for every empire since the Venetian Empire of the medieval period. It holds for the Castilian or Spanish Empire in the 17th century. It is true of the Dutch Empire in the 18th century and the French Empire in that period too, of the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century and the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the 19th century. It is also true of the British Empire in the 20th century. And what's great is that the United States just crossed the threshold, began to violate Ferguson's Law in 2024, as you can see from this chart. And it's on a clearly unsustainable path. Congressional Budget Office does its best to anticipate the trajectory of American public finance, of the deficit, of the debt. You can back out the likely trajectory of defense spending from CBO projections, and you can also see where interest payments will go. And so what I've done in this chart is just to calculate these things as percentages of GDP using the CBO data, and you can see that the interest payments rise steadily relative to GDP, and the defense budget, in fact, declines. So that by 2036, 10 years from now, the United States, on current trends, will be spending twice as much on interest payments on the federal debt as on defense. This is entirely novel from the vantage point of American history. But it is far from novel if you're a student, as I am, of empires and history. To add to the challenge, this is happening at a time when the United States faces its most formidable ever economic rival. This chart calculates China's gross domestic product as a percentage of the United States going back to 1980, when, as you can see, it was a mere 10% the size of the US economy. It's now above 70%, according to the International Monetary Fund. That's on a current dollar basis. The economics nerds in the audience will know that on a purchasing power parity basis, China overtook the United States at some point in the last decade. But on a current dollar basis, which is kind of what I think matters more, the Chinese are much closer to being equals of the United States than the Soviet Union ever was. Because the Soviet Union, even on a PPP basis, never got closer than about 44% of US GDP. It gets worse. China's rise to dominate global manufacturing is another unprecedented challenge. So if you go back 20 years ago, US manufacturing value added was twice that of China. Today, role reversal. Today, China's is very nearly twice that of the United States. The workshop of the world is no longer the United States. The arsenal of democracy is no longer an arsenal. There's an arsenal of autocracy, and its capital is Beijing. Now, the interesting thing about President Trump's response to these challenges, the economic challenge and the geopolitical challenge, is how really Nixonian his answers are. And I don't think people pay nearly enough attention to the influence of Richard Nixon on Donald Trump. And I don't know why they don't. Because the relationship between the young Donald Trump and the elderly more or less discredited Richard Nixon is well documented. This is a letter from Richard Nixon to Donald Trump, dated December the 21st, 1987. Dear Donald, I won't do the accent. I did not see the program, but Mrs. Nixon told me that you were great on the Donahue show. As you can imagine, she is an expert on politics, and she predicts that whenever you decide to run for office, you will be a winner. Here's Trump with Nixon at a March 1989 fundraiser. So whenever people are trying to tell you that Trump is Hitler or Augustus Caesar or William McKinley, no. He is, at some level, Richard Nixon's revenge. They have the same enemies. Harvard, the New York Times, the fake news, the bureaucracy. Nixon called it the bureaucracy, Trump the deep state. The Nixonian parallels are very striking. Let me give you two examples of this. The first is the summer of 1971. Where were you in the summer of 1971? It's interesting to think back. I was quite young at that point. I wasn't tracking American politics especially closely at the age of seven, but Richard Nixon did two remarkable things that summer. He dropped two bombshells, and he dropped those bombshells on America's allies. The first was to announce, to the utter consternation of his Asian allies, that he intended to go to Beijing, they called it Peking then, and meet Mao Zedong. And then, a month later, he dropped another bombshell, which was to break the link between the dollar and gold, the vestigial remnant of the Bretton Woods system, and impose a 10% across-the-board tariff on all imports into the United States. The Japanese still refer to the Nixon shoku, the Nixon shock. And I want to suggest to you that what we saw last year was Donald Trump's version of the Nixon shock. First, the diplomatic blow, which was actually delivered by Vice President Vance at the Munich Security Conference, a blow directed at European confidence in the Atlantic relationship, and then, of course, Liberation Day, the blow of tariffs even higher than 10% across the board, the so-called reciprocal tariffs. Now, the problem with what President Trump did last April is, firstly, that it's not clear that tariffs can really strengthen the US economy. This might seem self-evident to you, but it is worth dwelling on. The Yale Budget Lab does regular updates on where the effective tariff rate stands. And since the Supreme Court ruling against the IEEPA basis for the reciprocal tariffs, they've had to update it. But roughly speaking, the average effective tariff rate is now close to 12%, assuming, which I think is reasonable, that the Section 122 tariffs become permanent, it'll be above 12%. That is 10 times where the effective tariff rate was at the beginning of the Trump era. And it transports us back to the tariff rates last seen in the 1940s, which is a remarkable fact. If you had told 100 economists 2 years ago that the effective tariff rate would return to where it was in the 1940s, having been where it was in the early 1930s last year, 99 would have said very bad consequences will follow from that. When I was at Oxford, my roommate was a brilliant Korean economist named Hyun Song Shin. It was his misfortune to be next door to one of the most dissolute undergraduates who'd ever studied at Magdalen College. That was me. Hyun Song-shin was for years at the Bank for International Settlements. He's just been appointed governor of the South Korean Central Bank. He did some fantastic work at BIS on the nature of the global economy. And he showed that if you do network architecture of it, it's a very complex network of interrelated economic supply chains and balance sheets. And when you look at what he calls the two-step supplier-to-customer linkages, that is to say, the links from China to the United States, for example, that go via Mexico or Vietnam, it's as interrelated, it's as interconnected as ever has been. And tariffs don't really change that. Tariffs are a blunt instrument, a 19th century policy tool that you're applying to the extraordinarily complex global economy that has evolved since the 1980s. And it shapeshifts. It shapeshifts because the goods find the optimal way to the market. If they need to make two stops rather than one, that's what they do. So tariffs can have certain effects. If you look at the current account deficit of the United States, one effect is very noticeable in this chart here. You can see that the current account deficit was reduced last year. But what tariffs can't do is reduce the fiscal deficit. Even although last year the president and his advisors often said that tariffs would be a great source of revenue. They are a source of revenue, no doubt. But if you look at the projections for the federal deficit, it starts just under 6% of GDP this year, and it constantly grows until it's above 9% of GDP in the 2050s, at the end of the Congressional Budget Office's range of projection. And the other thing about tariffs is, despite the rhetoric of making America great again, they don't reshore or restore manufacturing jobs. In fact, employment in manufacturing since President Trump's re-election has declined. Nixon's strategy included not only tariffs, but also a weaker dollar. That was the real point of the August 1971 announcement. The dollar's decoupling from gold meant the dollar weakened against the European and Asian currencies. This was the origin of the great John Connolly line, "Our currency, your problem." Now, there was some talk of this from Stephen Miron, who now is at the Fed, but for a time was in charge of the Council of Economic Advisers. But when you actually look at what the dollar has done under President Trump, it is a nothing burger. This is a chart that covers the entirety of my lifetime as seen through the effective exchange rate of the dollar. That's the dollar's exchange rate relative to all of the currencies of its trading partners. And you can see that we've had some very big dollar devaluations. The 1970s, for example, which was the Nixon era, there was a big devaluation in the late 1980s. There was a big depreciation of the dollar prior to the financial crisis. But look at the Trump era. Nothing has really happened. It's a minimal depreciation, not really enough to move the economic needle. But the parallels get better. Now I want to transport you to 1973. By this time, I was somewhat more aware at the age of 9. And I certainly was becoming aware of inflation. The first publication of my life was a letter to the Glasgow Herald, written, I think, the following year, complaining about the excessively high price of school shoes. So inflation was always an interest of mine. You could say I was precocious or maybe just a typical penny-pinching Scotsman. What happened in 1973? Well, here are two New York Times front pages to tell you. Arabs and Israelis battle on two fronts. Egyptians bridge Suez, air deals and tents. A surprise attack on Israel, the Yom Kippur War. Egypt and Syria attack Israel. And then we fast forward to November the 10th. Kissinger fails to sway Saudis from oil embargo. Because President Trump is subconsciously or perhaps consciously reenacting the Nixon presidency, we have to have a war in the Middle East and an oil shock. Now, compared with 1973, the United States is far more militarily dominant in the Middle East. In the 1970s, the Soviet Union could deploy substantial military forces to the region, and therefore action in the Middle East was very risky. There was a moment in the Yom Kippur War when it seemed as if the Soviets were going to intervene and send troops of their own, as well as warships, into action. It was one of the most tense moments in the Cold War. We don't have to worry about the Russians in that way anymore. They've been drastically reduced as a force in the region, especially in the last couple of years. And as we saw after February the 28th, the United States has the capability to inflict extraordinary military damage on a country such as the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the first days of the war, these charts go up to March 17. So really, the first 2.5 weeks of the war. These are the missiles and the drones that the Iranians were able to fire at their neighbors. Their retaliation strategy was a surprising one. They retaliated more against their Arab Gulf neighbors than against Israel or the United States. But look at the decline. It's an exponential decline in the capacity to fire missiles, not quite so drastic in the case of drones. By the standards of any war in history, this is an astonishing achievement, American Blitzkrieg. But now we come to the second problem of Trump-Nixon. Despite having been, to a vast extent, disarmed, the Iranian regime has sufficient firepower, enough of a threat in the form of missiles and drones, to close the Strait of Hormuz. You can tell by now that I like charts. One of the reasons I went to the United States was I just found that people liked charts there more than they did at Oxford. This is my favorite chart of the moment. This is the number of crossings in either direction, by boats, by tankers of and ships of varying types through the Strait of Hormuz. And this is the war beginning, and this is where we are now. This is a dramatic shock to the global economy, the magnitude of which is quite hard to grasp. So let me try and help you with, you guessed it, charts. See, if we calculate that, roughly speaking, 20% of the global oil market's going through the Strait of Hormuz, but the Iranians were able to export some despite the recently imposed blockade, and the Saudis could increase the amount that they sent with their pipeline to the Red Sea, et cetera, various ways in which you compensate. You lift sanctions on the Russian ships, et cetera. It's still 10%. Of global oil, even after all these adjustments. And here are the oil production changes in percentage terms, this is the 10% I just mentioned, compared with all the previous crises in the Middle East, including the Yom Kippur War of 73, the Iranian Revolution of 78, 79, which Professor Elvandi and I were just discussing. He has a new book coming out about that. I highly recommend it. Nothing that has happened in all the Gulf Wars, in all the Middle Eastern crises since 1973 comes close to what is happening now. If there's one thing I want to convey to you, it is the scale of the shock to the global economy that is currently unfolding. Because it's not just oil. Oil inventories are being depleted rapidly. The inventories were a cushion, like the strategic petroleum reserves, but they are being depleted rapidly. And then we have urea. Then we have aromatics and naphtha. Then we have the various petrochemicals that are dependent on supply from the Strait of Hormuz. The price action is striking. But this is a crisis that moves at the speed of an oil tanker or a container ship. It's not like a virus. The COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, moved at the speed of a jet plane. This thing is moving at the speed of a tanker, and it hasn't yet reached the United States. It's only really impacted the United States through the price of gasoline, which adjusts immediately to the price of crude oil, which is a global price. Unless the Strait of Hormuz is reopened very soon, the United States runs the risk not just of higher inflation, but also of recession. Another book for you to read, just out, by the brilliant Tyler Goodspeed, Recession, the Real Reasons Economies Shrink and What to Do About It. This is an amazing piece of applied economic history by one of the most brilliant people I ever had the good fortune to teach. Very cool data. Of 23 recessions in the US since 1902, nearly half were wholly or partly due to energy shocks, Goodspeed shows. Now, you're all beginning to think, I know what you think. I know what you're thinking. You acquire the power of telepathy after a certain point. I know what you're thinking, but just bear with me. The oil shock of 1973-74, which I already told you was less of a shock than the shock we see now, took Henry Kissinger 4 months to sort. 4 months of negotiation, actually slightly more than four, to get the Saudis to lift the embargo. And in that period, what you can see is that not only did the price of oil rise by a factor of four, that's the red line, and not only did Richard Nixon's approval continue to fall off a cliff, that actually predated the oil shock for reasons that you probably know about. Begins with W. But here's the US stock market. That's the thing I want you to look at. The US stock market has a massive swallow dive. It actually went down 45% peak to trough in Nixon's second term. And this is what you were thinking. Why isn't that happening today? Where is the equivalent stock market crash? So I can show you in this table here that there was a stock market correction. It wasn't really a big correction. It was a small downward move in the period in the first 4 weeks of the war. So peak to trough, the NASDAQ is down 5.6%. Compared with the pre-war data, Feb 27, before the war begins, today the NASDAQ is up 14%. Up 14%. This is a puzzle. If the economic shock is as bad as I say, why are stocks up? Because believe me, if they were down, President Trump would be behaving quite differently. There are three possible explanations that I sketch out on this slide. One is investors are geniuses. They just see through the noise, and they see the war's over. It's actually over. And normal service will be resumed just in no time at all. Theory one. Theory two, the markets are as clueless as they were in July of 1914, in September of 1929, December of 1972, in August of 2000, October 2007, February 2020. The markets peaked in all those months. And then the shoe dropped. I can still remember wandering around Washington in February 2020, like, guys, this is the biggest pandemic since 1918-19. You are truly in trouble. No, 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 it's just the flu. It'll be over by Easter. Same in 2007. I'm like, guys, there's a huge financial crisis coming. You're in real trouble here. Ah, Neil. You academics, always so pessimistic, always so gloom and doom. Okay, Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the biggest energy shock ever is no big deal. So here's the third explanation. Never mind the Strait of Hormuz, as they used to say, feel the AI. So these are the possible explanations. One, the war's over, it was no big deal. Two, the market's just completely missing it. Three, AI is more important than the oil shock. Well, I can see why AI is exciting. Exponential growth and annualized recurring revenue is exciting. These are the Anthropic model adoption rates, which are also exponential. On the other hand, the polling on AI is not exactly warm and fuzzy. So the investors are in love with AI, the voters not so much. Here's the other thing about AI. It is cool for Lego videos. I don't know if any of you have been watching the Iranian Lego videos. They're kind of cool, actually. It's impressive to me that the IRGC has a Lego video division. And I like Lego videos as much as the next man, but, you know, it's not a war-winning weapon. So it's not going to turn the tide of the conflict. This brings me to the third problem. And this is the geopolitical problem. Sprigg Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, wrote a book in the mid-1990s, The Grand Chessboard, in which he said the worst case scenario, the most dangerous scenario, would be a grand coalition of China, Russia, and perhaps Iran. That was the worst case scenario. Hello? So there was no axis of evil in 2002. That was just made up by David Frum. But there actually is an axis of upheaval or authoritarians, or you can call them the crinks if you like. And it's actually worse than Brzezinski's worst case scenario because you've got Little Rocket Man, who didn't make it into Brzezinski's scenario. One really obvious consequence of all these Trump shocks is the American alliance system is in the most profound crisis of our lifetimes. I can hardly convey to you the extent of the alienation between Washington and the European capitals, not to mention London, and the Japanese are not really loving it despite Mrs. Takeuchi's forced smile in the Oval Office. But the bigger deal is how much it benefits the Axis. I took these photographs in Kyiv in September to show you what a cruise missile does to an apartment building when it hits it and kills dozens of people sleeping there, including the woman whose handbags caught my eye. For me, that's just the pathos of war in one striking image. That's happening pretty much weekly in Ukraine, and the drone strikes are nightly. This chart shows you the frequency of Russian missile and drone strikes. The drones are blue, the missiles are orange. The Russians can carry on doing this for another year with oil at current prices.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question. Like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
But the thing I want to leave you with is another strait altogether. You know, the Strait of Hormuz is a big deal. I've made that clear. But it's not as big a deal as the Strait of Taiwan. The Taiwan Strait is the big deal. Now, a couple of interesting data points about that. Number one, you would be surprised how hawkish the American public is on this issue. So last year, the Chicago Council asked, would you favor using the U.S. Navy to break a Chinese blockade around Taiwan, even if this might trigger a direct conflict between the United States and China? 47% of the sample said yes, 51% of Republicans. Meanwhile, in China, sentiment on the issue is also growing more hawkish. Substantially larger numbers than a year ago agree, or a year and a half ago, agree with the statement that Taiwan should be unified by force. The economic consequences of a Taiwan Strait crisis be far larger than the economic consequences of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, for the simple reason that nearly all the advanced semiconductors, that's less than 7 nanometers in size, are manufactured there, on the island of Taiwan, by TSMC. And the interesting thing about this island, as you may possibly have heard, is that China says it belongs to China. So here's a question that I keep pondering. Why might Xi Jinping shorten his timeline and make a move against the Strait of Taiwan? A couple of reasons. Number one, the United States has just expended roughly half of its key weapons of offense and defense in its war against Iran. Something like half the Tomahawks gone. This drastic depletion of already too low stocks of missiles isn't going to be fixed anytime soon, because these things take many months, as this chart from the Payne Institute shows, to replace. The empty bins problem, which existed before this war, empty bins of missiles, has just got roughly twice as bad. But the other reason that Xi Jinping might not hang around is that we just told him that we possess a cyber nuke. What Anthropic announced when it announced Mythos is the ultimate cyber weapon, with vastly greater capabilities against operating systems and software. Now, OpenAI can say GPT 5.5 is just as good. DeepSeek can't say that, because DeepSeek is clearly significantly behind the frontier models in the United States. So you start off being Richard Nixon, but maybe you end up being John F. Kennedy. Because the Taiwan semiconductor crisis, if it happens, will be the Cuban Missile Crisis of Cold War II. And it will certainly put an end to the theory that AI is awesome and we don't need to worry about the geopolitics of straits. Let me leave you with two questions. The Strait of Hormuz is closed. For how long? It's struck me that history is a bit different from economics. Rudy Dornbusch famously said that in a financial crisis, things, you know, take much longer to happen, and then they happen very suddenly, much faster than you could imagine. But in history, it's the opposite, particularly in the history of war. In the history of war, things start faster than you could possibly imagine, and then they take much, much longer to end. How many people in this room on February the 24th, 2022, would have predicted that the war in Ukraine would still be going on in May of 2026? Not one. So how long will the Strait of Hormuz be closed? 2 weeks? 2 months? And how long will the Strait of Taiwan be open? How long before that sudden thing happens that currently nobody seems to think is very likely? Just like nobody or very few people thought it was likely that Russia would invade Ukraine. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for putting up with all my charts. Now let's have a conversation.
Vic, I know there's going to be a lot of questions in the audience. But maybe I'll just open with, you're preaching to the already converted on the Nixon comparison.
Oh, good.
I always tell my students, I teach a course on American grand strategy, that that's the president to focus on if you want to understand Trump. But if we push this a little bit and we think about Trump's visit, so it was 54 years ago and a few months that Richard Nixon went to China. And you know, in the midst of a very unpopular war in the United States, and arguably he used that visit to strengthen America's position internationally, like creating a tacit alliance and so forth, and reducing some pressure on the military so it could go to a 1.5 war strategy than a 2-full war strategy. Didn't have to worry about China because Soviet Union would be worried about it. I take your point that Donald Trump wants to do big things like Richard Nixon did. So he's going to Beijing next week, unless it gets canceled. And with him, you don't know. But if he's going at a time when, it's a pretty unpopular war that the United States is conducting. We were talking about this in the elevator down. There's a story in the Washington Post that the CIA was briefing the White House that this war will go on for at least another 3 or 4 months. And before the Iranians are willing to settle. And he's going to Beijing with it's a very different China than Nixon, when Nixon was there. This is, as you pointed out, with all those graphs, they're pretty formidable. So the scenario I think that people are worried about in the region, I spend a lot of time in the region, is that Trump will actually do Xi Jinping's work for him. That he will make concessions on Taiwan. Not that he will say, oh, you can take Taiwan, but there'll be new wording about the relationship between the United States and Taiwan, or the issue of Taiwan's independence and so forth. That, you know, he's already kind of curbed arms sales to Taiwan. And there can be other things in the region. So, you know, I'm wondering if, like, what we, you know, I would like to get your thoughts about what this means for the U.S.-China relationship. I mean, one possibility is this very dark scenario, you know, where everybody is really forced, the thing escalates up, and, you know, the U.S. and the Chinese have to make some serious decisions. But the other is that, you know, Xi Jinping takes advantage of this position. Trump would be going there in a fairly weak position. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, Peter, the Nixon in China fantasy is just such a good illustration of where Trump's head is. This idea that it would just be one of those capstone moments to be given the red carpet treatment in Beijing. But of course, it's a very different China, and it's a very different situation. It made brilliant strategic sense to accept the Chinese invitation that Kissinger secured in 1971 at a time when the Soviet Union and China were in effect at war, right, or extremely close to it. And the Chinese were extremely worried that the Soviets were going to, in fact, launch a nuclear strike against them. Sergei Radchenko's brilliant recent book, To Run the World, shows that paradoxically the principal strategic rival of the Cold War was in fact within the communist bloc, between the Soviet Union of Socialist Republics and the People's Republic of China. So they were divided, and all that Nixon and Kissinger had to do was take advantage of that fact and accept the invitation that Mao issued precisely because he felt so insecure. Today, the axis between President Xi and President Putin is the exact opposite. It is very close. They probably meet more frequently than any two world leaders. And they have persistently affirmed their mutual interest. So it's, I think, misleading to say, as some of Trump's advisors have, that Trump has an opportunity to do a reverse Nixon, somehow to get either one or other of these countries to come over to the US side. That is not going to happen as long as Putin's running Moscow and Xi's running Beijing. If you go to China now, what exactly is on the agenda?
Well, you
already lost the trade war. This is a point that hasn't often enough, I think, been recognized. That last year, Trump escalated tariffs to a virtual embargo on China. The tariffs were in excess of 100%. The Chinese were the only players in the trade war last year who retaliated and raised tariffs on the US more or less tit for tat. And then they played an ace, which was to restrict the export of rare earth elements on which we largely depend, for which we largely depend on China. Collapse of American position and rapid reduction of US tariffs. So are you going to talk about that? It's hardly worth discussing because you not only lost in the trade war, but you also lost at the Supreme Court, and you're trying to cobble together your tariffs on the basis of various alternative legal bases. Do you talk about semiconductors? The Trump administration is completely divided in this issue. Some people, aided and abetted by Jensen Huang of NVIDIA, want to sell the highest level chips to China. The national security people are like, are you absolutely insane? That's the one thing we've got that they don't have. So there's no coherence on the Trump side about that issue. So what are you going to talk about? What will you talk about? Of course Taiwan will come up because the Chinese always bring it up. They've been bringing it up since 1971. It was the first item on the agenda when Kissinger met Zhou Enlai. So they're going to bring it up. And the president's going to be sat there with his advisors whispering in his ear, don't change our position. Don't say that. Stick to the script. And you're dealing with the person least able to stick to a script in the whole world, like the whole of humanity. No. Trump is the person least able to stick to a script. So the probability that he goes off script in Taiwan is not trivial. And I think this is what worries not only the Taiwanese, but I think with good reason the Japanese. So I think that the trip to China was always, I thought, perilous. I felt that in January when I talked to US officials, when it wasn't clear what the agenda was, except, as one of them said, the president wants this to be very big.
Right.
Like a big photo opportunity, but with no content? That's hard to pull off. It's now, I think, much more tricky because the US is in a weak position. China also plays a key role with respect to Iran. Bear in mind, the Chinese didn't dare send weapons to the Russians because Jake Sullivan told them, if you do that, secondary sanctions. But the Chinese are openly providing military assistance to Iran, including targeting assistance, and we've done nothing. So the president is going to Beijing in really quite a weak position. I'm not sure what leverage he has. And as I said, Xi Jinping therefore has quite a bit of agency here, and he has to choose. The path of least resistance, which I think is what most people expect him to do, is to kind of give Trump a photo opportunity, not really do too much more than that, and just count down to the Taiwanese election in January of 2028 and continue to schmooze the Kuomintang and hope that it all just happens without much effort through the political channel.
Maybe buy some Boeings.
And then do some trade deals with the executives who'll be there, because the Chinese actually quite want to get back to a more normal business relationship. They're always trying to get the US to invest more in China. But he has an alternative option, which I think is the, to my mind, tempting one, which is take advantage of the fact that the United States is clearly not in a position to take military action in the Indo-Pacific theater, and take advantage of the fact that you still have time before the United States does the kind of preemptive action against you that it has done against Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, that it tried to do against the Iranians. If I'm Xi Jinping, thinking like a Marxist-Leninist, you'd be surprised to hear that I can do that. But I have spent a great deal of my career studying Marxist-Leninists. If I put myself in his head, he has to assume that the United States has a plan for regime change in China and a preemptive military option. So he can wait till January 2028 and hope that the Taiwanese election goes well, but that's a lot of time in which all kinds of things can be done, including using Mythos and its capabilities to launch a massive cyber attack on the CCP. If I were him, I wouldn't hang around.
So it's a damage limitation. Move quickly.
I would have the sweetest possible summit. I would smile and talk about win-win cooperation. And the minute Air Force One took off, I'd send Coast Guard vessels to Taiwan and say, we're here to collect the customs because this is part of China. That would be, I think, checkmate. I'm not sure whether he has the appetite to take that risk. We hotly debate this in the United States at the Hoover Institution. My former student Ike Fryman has a book just out defending Taiwan, which I highly recommend, another reading recommendation. And he certainly thinks this gray zone option is a real one. So I think this is the big risk that we aren't thinking enough about because our minds are focused on the front page and the Strait of Hormuz.
Okay, great. I'm going to open it up here. So hands. Let's give a few minutes, a few seconds here.
I'm leaving the selection to you.
Yes, the selection's going to be mine. How about that gentleman in the, yes, you just turned, it's kind of a, I think, a grayish jersey. Yeah, right up there, two-thirds or three-quarters of the way up. First question, please introduce yourself.
I think on the other side, is that who you meant?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ramin, a fellow economic historian and a chart lover. So another analogy, Nixon analogy, comes to my mind, and I wanted to know your thoughts on that. The tensions between Nixon and Arthur Burns, the head of the Federal Reserve, right? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, given the chances that we're going to have possibly a recession, and then that could create more tension between Donald Trump and the Fed.
Okay, hold on for 1 second. We're going to take three questions.
Okay.
So we're
going to...
Looking around.
Great question.
I'm looking for a woman out here. So there we go. Right up here in the front.
Hi, I'm Harshita Khemka from Queen Mary University. I'm doing master's in investment and finance. My question to you is, what do you think about UAE exiting the OPEC, and what would be the economic repercussions, especially for the U.S. economy?
Another great question.
Yeah, and then we're going to go online here with Chris. So if you just bring it down to Chris Gilson here. Yeah.
Thank you. Just to say that there are more than 350 people watching tonight online from countries including Poland, Canada, India, Mexico, Brazil, Kenya, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Malaysia, Singapore, Germany, the UK, and the US. The first online question is from Isabel James, who asks, what would be some signs that China would be preparing to invade Taiwan? And will the West react preemptively or wait? Thank you.
Okay. Three great questions. As you say, once you start thinking about the Nixon parallels, you just keep thinking of more. I thought you were going to say something different. I thought you were going to say, and isn't there a scandal which is like a cancer on the presidency that is slowly spreading its way into the White House? I mean, when the First Lady stood up and made her statement about Epstein, I thought this is getting eerily Watergate-like. But, you know, the monetary policy issue is a very important one. One reason that the United States had a severe stagflation problem in the 1970s was, it's generally recognized, Alan Meltzer says this in his great history of the Federal Reserve, that in effect the Fed lost its independence or never really had that much, and it had been eroded since the late 60s. It was actually Lyndon Johnson who began beating up on William McChesney Martin, and then, you know, Burns was a kind of academic, somewhat easily roiled by Nixon. Trump Warsh will be a different story. Full disclosure, Kevin Warsh is a friend of mine and a Hoover fellow. So what I'm going to say now is dispassionate, but I know him well. Kevin, unlike Arthur Burns, is not an academic. He has considerable experience, not only in the private sector, but at the Fed. He was at the New York Fed during the financial crisis. And he's highly respected in the world of Wall Street. And I think, particularly given the Supreme Court's clear ruling that the Fed is an independent entity, Kevin Warsh's problem is not going to be the president. Kevin's problem is going to be the other members of the FOMC, especially former Chair Powell stays on. That will be a hard body to manage if you have 4% inflation, maybe even higher, depending on how long the strait stays closed, a real economic slowdown, not necessarily a recession. To get to a recession, you need the strait to be closed until, I'd guess, Labor Day. Then they are going to have a tough job, because the hawkish people will say, we actually need to raise rates, and the dovish people will say, we just hold them steady. But nobody's going to be talking about cuts at that point. So I think it's a very good analogy, but I don't think it's going to be Kevin Warsh being bullied by Trump on Truth Social. I think it's more like Kevin struggling to manage an FOMC, which will probably be quite divided in that context. The lady from Queen Mary. I had the pleasure of interviewing the UAE ambassador to Washington, Youssef Al-Otaiba, earlier this week at the Milken Conference. And we talked about this. His father, it turned out, had been president of OPEC for like six terms. The longest ever president of OPEC. I said, this must have been kind of a little bit of ruction in the family when you announced you're leaving OPEC. And he said, no, because my father agreed. This is the time. It's served its purpose. OPEC no longer has that large market share. Looking behind the diplomatic rationalization, this has been coming for a time, but the perfect opportunity is now. Do it now when oil prices are high and the pressure is not on to limit your production. And of course, this reflects the deep split that is emerging between the Emiratis and the Saudis. So I read this as part of that drama, where the GCC is beginning to fragment under the strains of this conflict, but also under previous strains that predate Operation Epic Fury. And I think the Emiratis have made a very clear decision that their alignment is with the United States and Israel. That is their future. And the Saudis, not so much. I think the Saudis are hedging. MBS is on the phone to Xi Jinping. I think there's a much more complex game being played there. And this is just a part of it. Finally, the question that came from the online participant, I don't think invasion is very likely of Taiwan. I think that is the least likely scenario because A, it's very difficult. B, I'm not sure the People's Liberation Army is capable of it, especially not having had its ranks, its senior ranks, purged by Xi Jinping to the point that the military commission is basically has basically been cleaned out. There are other options. There's a blockade option, which they've rehearsed. They rehearsed that quite regularly. They did a big rehearsal of blockade back in January, end of last year, beginning of this year.
But that too has its risks, because the United States has considerable naval capabilities. And when I look at Sam Paparo, the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, I see somebody who would quite enjoy fighting a full-scale naval war with China. So I would say the blockade strategy has its risks. That's why these gray zone options, where you don't actually take military action, you do something that is a sort of legalistic lawfare move, and you say, this is a province of China. You all agree, right? This is a province of China. We're just going to collect the customs, okay? And a lot of governments around the world will not fight that. A lot of corporations will not fight that. And if you want to be really legalistic and nerdy about it, Taiwan had a, and still has a, special commercial status under the WTO, dating back to Chinese accession. And Hong Kong used to have that status too, until it was revoked by, drumroll, President Donald Trump in 2020. So the Chinese can say, oh, in just the same way that you cease to recognize Hong Kong's commercial autonomy, we're doing the same, because this is a province of China. Now, if they do that, my colleague Phil Zelikow has made this point, and Ike Fryman writes about it too, then what? Then what do you do? Because then it would be the United States that would appear to escalate if it took action to, say, open a corridor allowing goods to go in and out of Taiwan that the Chinese couldn't control. Obviously, if the Chinese establish control over Taiwan's trade, that's it. Game over, thanks for playing. Because then they can do export controls on the chips. They can also do import controls on the LNG. They can shut Taiwan down. They would have control. So this is the move that is most concerning to U.S. policymakers, because it would be hard to counter, other than by appearing to escalate. And I asked a French advisor to President Macron not so long ago, how many European countries would side with the United States in a Taiwan crisis? And he replied, zero.
We take another couple questions from, how about the gentleman right there?
Melville Rodriguez. Do you draw parallels between the US-Iran experience with the Suez crisis?
Not only do I, but I have. I wrote a piece for the Free Press. It was also published in the London Times, which had as its headline, American Suez. Because it is very similar when you think about it. Conservative leader decides to do regime change. Then it was 1956, it was Anthony Eden, the country was Egypt. Yeah. Today it's Trump, the country's Iran. You do it in partnership with the Israelis. French were also involved in 1956. You achieve military success. Egyptian forces were comprehensively defeated in 1956. But then you discover that the strategic waterway has been blocked. And then the economic pain kicks in. Now, the economic pain was pretty fast acting in 1956, because the sterling peg to gold and to the dollar came under immediate attack, and the Bank of England had to start intervening. And that was really when Harold Macmillan, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, realized that it was all unraveling. So that unraveled quite rapidly, though it wasn't really all over until the end of the year. Here, the economic pain is slower acting, because the United States is a stronger economy than Britain in 1956, and there isn't another bigger economy that's waiting to take market share, because the United States is the United States. We were the United Kingdom, still an imperial power, but the United States was already manifestly a more powerful economy. So the analogy is not perfect. Analogies never are in history. But the way this is going is very American Suez, because the United States is now in a significantly weak position in the negotiations that are going on with the Iranians. And the Iranians are clearly incentivized to drag these negotiations out until the economic pain fully hits the United States. And I believe that's what they will do.
Fellow in the orange right there.
I'm hoping we're getting some questions from students here.
We are. Here we go. Unless I'm wrong.
Hi, thanks so much for this talk, Professor Ferguson. I'm Edmund. I'm a PhD student at UCL. My question is, I once did some research experience for the late, great LSE professor Chris Coker, who's argued, I think a few years ago, that one of the things that China does with the Belt and Road Initiative is use what he calls debt entrapment. That means that if a country defaults on its obligations to China, China might reserve the right to repossess a port that it's built for said country and turn it into a military harbor. And I was wondering if this is, you know, and he also thinks that part of China's aims might be more maximalist than is traditionally thought. It might even want to go up through the island chains to Hawaii. And I was wondering if this gets, you know, part of your talk, blending the economics and the politics, that is it the problem that America faces is not just that kind of geopolitical with the rise of China, but also, as you suggest, financial, that the degree to which America is dependent on foreign credit with a kind of $27 trillion negative international investment position, yep. Is that kind of the crux of the crisis, do you think, the rise of China plus international credit? Or is there, do you think something else is the crux of this crisis? Thanks.
Well, that's a very interesting question. People have been talking for years. I can remember these conversations going on during Barack Obama's presidency about whether the United States was vulnerable to the Chinese selling U.S. treasuries. That was a kind of discussion back in those days. And I never found that very plausible because the market for U.S. treasuries is a global market. They are still seen as the safe asset in the international financial system. And even if foreign holdings have somewhat diminished, and especially of Chinese holdings, the reason for that is to try and reduce the exposure of China to U.S. sanctions, not to exert pressure on the United States. The Chinese are probably accumulating gold for that reason. The United States also has a way of managing the U.S. Treasury market, which is called the Federal Reserve. And since the Fed, ever since the advent of quantitative easing, has essentially had a debt management function in all but name, the Fed has essentially substituted for foreign sellers. So I don't think that's a particular vulnerability right now. I think the lesson of, going back to the earlier question of Suez, is if you're a great power and you have that kind of potential vulnerability, the fatal thing is to suffer a major strategic defeat. Because in conditions of strategic defeat, and they were unmistakable in 1956 for Britain, the rest of the world has less of an appetite for your currency and for your debt. Now, the United States is not yet, it seems to me, visibly defeated. That's still an open question because of its enormous military capability. In my view, President Trump's great mistake was that 4 or 5 weeks ago, he had the option to take control of the Strait by force, and he blinked. And by blinking, he gave the Iranians leverage that they'd never had before. This was a grave strategic blunder. Is it salvageable? It's hard now. It's hard now to restart this war, and I'm not sure he will. But in that sense, the United States isn't manifestly a kind of defeated empire. I wrote this book, Colossus, quite a long time ago. I always like to sell my own books at the end. It's kind of the only way us historians can really make a buck, unless we do shameless podcasts. So Colossus made the argument that the United States had these three deficits, and that was why its empire was an unstable one that made it quite different from Britain's imperial project. The three deficits were manpower deficit, because Americans really don't actually want to go and live on the Strait of Hormuz, whereas there were British people who thought that that was an improvement. Especially Scottish people. It's like Glasgow, Strait of Hormuz. I'll try the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah, sounds good. Sunny, isn't it? So the manpower deficit. The second deficit was the fiscal deficit, which was already an issue back when I was writing the book 2003. And then the attention deficit. And that's the most important one. That the great American public just loses interest in these dramas abroad. And in this case, it never had interest, because the polling was bad for the war pretty much on day one. So these are the vulnerabilities, I think, that are significant, rather than the one that you're pointing out.
So we have a few minutes left here, and maybe I'll put one last question to
sure.
you and help us connect to next year's series. So let's imagine that Xi Jinping decides to wait for that second election in 2028, the U.S. election. And let's imagine that J.D. Vance loses in a closely fought contest with a really bright, young, smart senator from Georgia who happens to be an LSE alum as well, John Ossoff. The Democrats have already taken the House by 25 seats in 2026. They take the Senate by a couple of seats. The election has nothing to do really with Iran. It's about affordability. It's about regulating AI. It's about plundering plutocrats. And so the question I think I would like to have you address is, what from the Trump years on the foreign policy front sticks? What is it that the Democrats, you know, reverse or soft pedal? And what is it that they maybe just quietly accept and move on?
Well, in a way, we ran the experiment already in 2021. Many people thought when Joe Biden won the 2020 election that there would be a kind of return to normalcy. That was the expectation amongst many Europeans. The adults were back in the room. And it was also the expectation at places like Harvard and Stanford, where I spend time. And this turned out to be quite wrong. The trade policy was more or less unchanged. They didn't remove the tariffs. Mm-hmm. Those stayed. They refined the tech war that had begun when Trump went after Huawei. Mm-hmm. But what Jake Sullivan did as National Security Advisor was to make that tech war somewhat more sophisticated. And then, of course, they did industrial policy, something that Trump, in some ways, has sought to do. So the continuities from Trump to Biden were much greater than most people anticipated, specifically on those issues. Of course, the Biden administration got into terrible trouble with inflation, partly because of its own fiscal recklessness in year one and partly because of the war in Ukraine. Now Trump's having the exact same problem, where he's taking the one issue about which the public is hypersensitive, affordability, and making it worse. So I think if Trump does become a lame duck because they lose both houses, I mean, I think both chambers. I mean, I think that's still not 100% certain because the Senate is a tough one for Democrats this year. But I think it's now in play. I think it's getting close to 50-50 that can happen, especially if I'm right about the economic pain only just beginning. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of Trump's presidency will have that Nixonian quality because he'll be impeached. This time they have great material to work with. I mean, way better material. The Democrats aren't going to know where to begin. Is it going to be insider trading or maybe the coin scams? Or I don't know, let's go back to the Epstein files. They have so much material to work with. And that will be it for Donnie from Queens. It'll be really hard for him to do anything under those circumstances. And all the enemies will gather around, sensing a rerun of the Nixon presidency. After all, the problem about having Richard Nixon as a role model is that's why nobody else has Richard Nixon as a role model. It's like the series two doesn't end well, Donnie. But you're right, I think under those conditions, the Democratic nominee has a pretty good chance. J.D. Vance has to first be sure of being the Republican nominee. Sure. Judging by Marco Rubio's current behavior, the race is on already. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting one will be the Democratic race. And I think you're right to look for somebody who's not really in the conversation right now. somebody who's not Gavin Newsom, who's not AOC. There are a bunch of contenders from reddish states. Mm-hmm. Galago in Arizona is one. And we wouldn't really have heard of this person until sometime late next year. I mean, in the same way that I really hadn't got Barack Obama on my radar until November 2007. So somebody is going to be president of the United States that most people here have not heard of. And that person will then continue many Trump policies while, of course, using a completely different rhetoric, and will deeply disappoint the Europeans, just as Joe Biden deeply disappointed the Europeans, and will probably disappoint the Harvard professors and the Stanford professors too, because that's American politics. Just to kind of conclude the thought, if it is a complete reenactment of the Nixon presidency, like a complete reenactment, and the stock market completely craters, and then all the Republican senators who secretly hate Donald Trump and always have hated him will suddenly be like, you know what? You know, maybe we should impeach this guy, which is what ultimately happened to Nixon. And then J.D. Vance gets to be president in the same way that Gerry Ford got to be president. That scenario kind of fascinates me, that we might have a complete reenactment. But then the other possibility, which I kind of left you with in the talk, is maybe we're not in the 1970s at all. Maybe we're in the early Cold War. And all these attempts to assassinate Trump just kind of keep sending me back to the Kennedy presidency. There are ways that this can end that are not entirely conventional. And that is, of course, why the study of American politics and history is such a tremendously absorbing subject. And we have, I hope, illustrated that in our conversation this evening.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.